Blog Talk Radio.
Where's that doorman? I've got this man on a payroll. I've got nothing out of him tonight. I don't know where he is. All right. But
General
once
quarters.
Again.
General quarters.
There he is.
Security condition 3.
GQ. Security 3, sir. General quarters 3. Intruder alert. GQ 3. Intruder alert.
Oh, you're going to think, intruder. Don't come in slow on a queue again. Hey, this is Madam Perry, and welcome once again to Madam Perry Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. I am your host and cruise director, as I said, Madam Perry, or you can call me Jennifer Perry or J-Mod, as the Brits do, and I am just thrilled to be here once again. First of all, let me thank everyone who's listening, subscribing, downloading, sharing with your friends. The numbers are out of sight, and I'm able to continue getting great guests and sponsors, and it's only because of you, because you make this, you're helping this show to grow, and I want to thank you so much. We've had so much fun lately. Hey, if you were listening last night, you know, my guest was Ricky Bird, whom you may know. He's played with everyone. As a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, he was inducted with his band, the band he was in at the time, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, and Ricky Bird. Ricky Bird, the guitarist, singer, musician. He's also played with Ian Hunter, just about everybody that you know that's famous he's played with. But he's been sober for 30 years. He has a foundation called Clean Getaway, which is also the name of his new CD, Clean Getaway. And he also has an offer. If you want to help him raise money for the foundation, Clean Getaway, where he goes around the different facilities that do where people with drug and alcohol dependency can get rehabilitation support, then he's got a special for you. For $25, you get the new CD and a special pick and a signed 8x10 picture. And of course, he will autograph personally the CD, all for $25, but you have to get it through PayPal, and I've got the social media for that and the contacts, the address, that's what it is, and on all of my social media. So Ricky Bird, and also we kind of quit in the middle last night, so Ricky is going to come back again for a part two. Also, later this month, we've got Pat Dogans, and he is a NASA expert. He's also an NPR reporter and anchor, but he's covered more space missions than probably any journalist that we know of, and has written several books about it. And he's going to be here the last week of November, the last Monday of November, so I'm extremely excited about that, and you'll be sharing more about that too. Tonight, even better. This is a subject that a lot of people may have forgotten about, and some still know. I think the way I put it on Facebook and so forth today was, if you know what the words deck and cover refer to for some of us in elementary school, or if you've ever heard the expressions effete intellectuals or nattering nabobs of negativism and a few other fun things like that, or remember when being called a communist was the greatest insult and sometimes the most dangerous accusation can make of a person, then you're going to enjoy this book. And even if not, this writer is fantastic. So I'm going to just bring him right in, introduce him to all of you, and I want you to welcome to Madam Perry's Salon author Donald Stenson. Don, come on into Madam Perry's Salon and get comfortable.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, very much.
Well, you're
I'm
quite welcome.
I'm
going to
take that big pillow over there.
I wish you would. Some of these things are new. I think, I don't know if I mentioned to you because I didn't want to frighten you, but I had a couple of suspense authors here one night, on the same night, Rick Cornell and Brett Wright. Rick is an attorney in Reno, and Brett Wright, he's a teacher in Denver, but you know what? He's a retired chief petty officer from the U.S. Navy, and yet the two of them smuggled in burritos and all kind of stuff like that and left some a big mess, so we had to have it redecorated. You know, you never know who's going to be your troublemaker, and, you know, an attorney, I mean, come on. I should have figured that before he even got in. But anyway, they're great guys, and I had them come in and clean the place out. But I'm so glad you're here, and I want you to be comfortable because I want you to come back again and again. Your book, your brand new book, is called Downstairs at the White House, Story of a Teenager in Oval Office and a Ringside Seat to Watergate.
Yes.
And it's all about when you were 17, sort of accidentally landing a job at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And during the worst political scandal in American history, and people these days think they know what scandal is, but this was nothing. And, you know, we're close to the same age, close enough to where I remember coming home and reading about this every day in the newspaper when I got home from school. They have no idea. And yet you write this book. You write with such a great sense of humor. I found myself bookmarking it all the way through with expressions that I may bring in. And another great thing you do right in the beginning, and folks, just in case, whether you know about this, whether you remember it, or whether you're a student of history, and by the way, let me say, the date of publication on this book was what day? It was just been a few weeks, right?
Officially, it was November 1st.
And yet you're already an Amazon bestseller in the category of presidents and head of state's biographies.
Yes. Thanks to a lot of wonderful readers.
Not too shabby. Yeah, but you got to give them something good to read. And this is it. And thankfully, for those of us whose memories might have dimmed, or for the people to whom this may be a brand new story, you very thoughtfully gave us a cast of characters in the beginning.
I did. And some of them were more characters than others.
And you know, even back then there were some comedians like Vaughn Metter and Lily Tomlin who would incorporate these people into their the people into their routines and their stuff, and a lot of it, especially on the Laugh USA channel, which is clean humor, they play a lot of that the Ernestine, the telephone operator, Lily Tomlin, talks to. Yeah, they still play that, and it still holds up. You know, if you know even just a little bit about a history, it still holds up, and it's funny. So you started into the story. You talk about when. Now you skipped your senior year of high school. Am I right? I was very fortunate.
Yes, I was very fortunate. Mm-hmm. There was a program at the time that allowed high school students to be able to apply to college at the end of their junior year. And so I did. And a friend of mine, who is one of the characters in the book, did the same thing. And we both ended up in Washington. And so part of this adventure involved him because we had been best friends in high school. And so we did some of these crazy things together. And then I ended up in the White House, and he did smart things like becoming a doctor, which he is today.
Okay. But you've remained friends all this time, and you apparently had many adventures, some that you can and cannot share, I would imagine.
Yeah.
If there are anything worth having, sometimes you can't share.
Very
until
true.
The statutes run out, but so forth, yeah. So, speaking as one who knows, so you end up at the White House at 17. Now, was this an internship, or how did you end up there?
No, I was a regular member of the staff, and what happened was I had gone to Washington in the fall of 1972. Which obviously was a presidential election year, and President Nixon was running for re-election against George McGovern, a senator from South Dakota. And I just kind of fell in. I didn't really have much of a political philosophy one way or the other. But I fell in with some of the folks who were doing some volunteer work at the Committee to Reelect the President, which later became known as CREEP in the alliteration for Committee to Reelect the President, and was referred to later on during Watergate. And I volunteered down there, and I got to know some people, and my friend, who is one of the characters in the book, Mark Edelman, Mark and I both did some of that work. And then I was very interested in trying to get a job, an internship, or a regular kind of job on Capitol Hill, and because I thought that was very cool and would add to my studies, and I got nothing but turndowns, just one after the next. And it prepared me for a life later on in sales, so that was a good thing, I guess. And one day I ran into a guy in my dorm. I don't know, maybe we were shaving or something in the morning. And we got into a conversation, and he said, I know you're looking for a job. And I've had one, and it doesn't really fit with my major or anything else, and I'm going to give it up. Would you be interested? And he gave me the name of some group or whatever, and I said, sure. Yeah, I mean, I certainly wasn't having any luck with anything else. So I ended up, and it was a month before my 18th birthday, going down to this big gray building in downtown Washington with him, which I had no idea what it was. I don't know if I could call myself, it would be flattering, I guess, to call myself naive. I think I was just stupid. And I really didn't recognize where I was headed. And so I spent a day there or whatever. And then I kind of followed him around and got a sense for it. And then I ended up being hired, and I worked for a group that was called the Council on International Economic Policy that was located in the old Executive Office Building, which is at the corner of 17th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington and is part of the White House complex. But I had no idea. So I got hired, and this is one of the stories that I told my children over the years who still think this is one of the funniest, and they like to use this to get me. Is that I was given an assignment. I was just a clerk. I mean, it was a part-time job to start with, a clerk and a messenger. And I was given a job to clean out an office that somebody had left. And so I'm working on it. And I open up one of the drawers. And in the drawer, and I describe this in the book, in the drawer is some stationery. And the stationery says, the White House, Washington, in blue ink and beautiful paper. And I went, oh, my God. And there was this very nice lady that was across the hall. Actually, she was in an office that was the same space where the Japanese had come to speak with the Secretary of State on December 7th, 1941, while the Japanese were bombing Pearl Harbor, and had come to the White House to express hopes for peace and everything else, and basically had just lied to the Secretary of State. It was right in that spot. So I walked across the hall, and I went to her, and she was lovely. And I said, you're not going to believe this. But in this guy's drawer is this White House stationery. And she was a wonderful person, because she could have gone, boy, you must be the biggest moron I've ever met. But instead, she very nicely explained to me where I was working, and that this building was part of the White House complex. So that's how I started off. And I had to do all sorts of things, including get a full field investigation from the FBI, and because in some cases I was carrying sensitive materials, and I was going to be around various people and things like that. And so that's kind of how I started. It wasn't an internship; I never had one, but I remained there as a paid employee. I was somewhere in the scheme of things in rank. I was somewhere below Lint. So I was right at the very bottom of the barrel. But, you know, that was a plus, Jennifer. And one of the reasons it was a plus was because I could do a lot of things that other people may not have been, because people weren't really inspecting me all that often because I was so low on the totem pole. So I got to wander around and do a lot of things. So that was a lot of fun. It was a great start. I really enjoyed it.
And it's interesting, too, when you start to describe the people, a lot of the people in the White House, and also when you talk about going to a place that you didn't know where the building you were at and stuff, a lot of people now just don't realize that back then, if you said that, you really meant that. It's not like you could just pull out a device and push a button or an app and find out exactly where you were and where you were going. And, you know, and
no.
You really had no idea. If you were lost, you were lost. And if you didn't recognize something, that was it. And so, yeah, and you were lost. And also, too, a lot of things were different. In the White House that you talk about, I mean, there were people – you describe a woman sitting in one office when she's got the big orange hair and, you know, an ashtray full of cigarette butts. And as she just kind of grunted and dismissed you because nobody was really concerned about, you know, customer service feedback or anything. That
no, they really weren't. That was actually on Capitol Hill, and she scared the dickens out of me because she was smoking and she had a can of aerosol hairspray that she was spraying at the same time, and I thought, this is going to be a recreation of the Hindenburg right here. Boom. So I left. I got out of there. It was awful.
Is that the one, and I was trying to flip through to see if I marked this in the book, that you described. And listen, folks, if you think politics, a book about politics, is dull, you have no idea. First of all, I'm a history buff anyway, so I'm always fascinated, you know, with reading, you know, true stories and about history and so forth. But especially when your perspective, and that's what I love, that you still have that fresh, innocent 17-year-old's perspective on this, you know, and yet you can kind of go in sort of like an outside looking in, you know, when you're somewhat, I don't want to say marginalized, but when you're new, you weren't that supervised, so you're kind of like a participant observer almost, kind of an inside but outside looking in, so nobody would notice what you noticed like that, and so you saw a lot of things. And what was the one where you were reporting? I was trying so hard to find this. You described a woman having and it might have been the same one, having the expression of was it a bulldog that had just licked a cactus?
Licking urine off of a cactus plant. Well, you know, I couldn't figure out another way to be able to paint that picture. But that's kind of what she looked like. I ran into. Again, she wasn't in the White House. These were that was somebody else on Capitol Hill. But they were, you know, one of the great things, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I started it actually as a sort of a memoir to leave behind one day for my family, because whether they wanted to or not, they heard these stories over the years. But because there are things about, you know, taking risks and just opening up your eyes, as those of us, you know, who have been around for a while realize, you know, you just got to open up your eyes and look around the world and be willing to try things. And because I had that kind of encouragement from my parents, I was able to do that. And I learned a lot. And I also saw a lot of hysterical things at the same time. So it was a benefit.
Hysterical and historical.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So first I thought, did his accent change that much since he left? Oh, he did mean hysterical and historical. Okay, so by the way, if you're listening to us live tonight, if you want to call in and talk to Don Stinson, the number is 646-716-9922, and Blog Talk Radio assures me that this is a toll-free call within the continental U.S. So 646-716-9922, call in and talk with me, or especially just if you want to talk to Don Stinson now. So, sorry, I'm getting so excited about how much I enjoyed your writing, not just the book,
oh, thank you.
And the subject and the way you tell the story, that that I know I'm jumping around. So let me get back to where so let me ask you this. Although this starts happening during, or like you're getting in there, and like I said, I may be jumping ahead now, but during the Watergate situation.
Right.
So tell me what that was like leading up to it. Now, I remember you talking about, first you were describing like going to the inauguration, it was just this freezing
mm-hmm.
cold day.
Yeah, you know, it was one of the, again, one of those things as a teenager, and having, and we were able to get, I'm sure because of clerical errors, my friends and I actually got tickets to some of these events. I can't imagine anybody
clerical
actually
errors.
Wanting us to go. I mean, I can't imagine. One of the things is I had remembered very vividly watching presidential inaugurations as a child on black and white, you know, grainy black and white TV sets. And just to be standing there on the what was then the east side of the Capitol, where the inauguration was held, which faces the Library of Congress, it was something, as many things are to people in your teenage years, it was bigger than life. And It was an amazing thing. Now, there's a kind of an interesting story. It is much disputed, but I think that your listeners might enjoy it, is that there was a reason. Ever since Ronald Reagan was sworn in 1981, the president faces west. And so that's the inauguration, the swearing in is done on the west side of the Capitol, which then faces the United States. But at that time, it had been done on the east side of the Capitol. And the reason for that, according to a legend, and I cannot vouch for the accuracy of it, was because it faced England. And it gave the new president an opportunity to give the finger to the royal family in England. And so it's one of those things where I would hate for truth to get in the way of a good story. But I don't know if it's true or not. But it's kind of a funny thing. And the but you know, that day in particular was it set what later became the standard. It was like the gold standard for demonstrators at a presidential inauguration. There had never been as many. There may have been an equal crowd later on. In the next 25, 30 years. But on that day in 1973, there seemed to be in many ways more demonstrators, and most of them, it was still a demonstration, obviously, against the Vietnam War. They were everywhere. And so those were... And I don't, you know, you sound at least 25 or 30 years younger than I am, so you wouldn't remember that. But those were extremely tense times. This country's been through very divisive, very tough times before, and certainly Vietnam was one of them. And there was occasional violence during those. There were lots of arrests and those kinds of things, and it marred some of the activities, and it was meant to. But we've struggled through those things in the past. And I remember standing on one corner. They said that they had more police at this than had ever been at any presidential inauguration. This one in 1973. And I remember standing next to a guy who was, he had on an old army jacket, dressed like most hippies did back in those days. This guy stunk to high heaven. I've never in my life ever smelled anything as bad as this guy. And someone said that he must have just, like, bathed in rotten chicken. I just to try to give you a sense for how bad that was. And later on, someone made the comment, and it may have been true, that he actually may have been a federal agent. So to try to, inside the crowd, to make sure, you know, people stayed off the parade route and things like that. And I don't know if he was or not, but certainly could have been. So it was filled with lots of characters and lots of kinds of things.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it does.
Because it certainly would work.
It does make sense. And but, you know, one of the things that I enjoyed at that age, and as some people say I still do now at 62, is did a lot of dumb things. And one of them that happened before that, actually it was on election night in 1972, was I was a volunteer. I did something very important, which was to direct people towards restrooms. And I ended up getting tired, and I wanted to find a place to sit down. And I sat next to these guys on some stairs in the Shoreham Hotel in Washington. And I looked at this one guy, and I kept going, "I know you from someplace." And I turned to him, and I said, "You know, you look familiar to me." And I guessed a couple of names, and he said, no. So finally he reaches out his hand, and he goes, "Don, nice to meet you. I'm Jim Brown." And for the people in the audience who don't remember Jim Brown, Jim Brown was probably the single greatest football player ever in the history of the world. But I didn't recognize – he was also a movie star. And I also – you know, I kind of recognized him, but I wasn't sure. And I said, did you play ball at one time? And he actually said he had played lacrosse. And a little football and that kind of thing. Well, I got so aggravated because this guy is obviously lying to me that I just got up and I walked away. And so 20 years later, I don't know how long ago, but it was probably 20 years later, I was reading this thing about Syracuse University athletics. And in it, I read that Jim Brown was not only in the Hall of Fame for football, but also for lacrosse. So, you know, I just stumble over funny kind of people like that. But, yeah.
That was one of my favorite stories in the book. If you could hold just one second there before we go further with that. And that was one of my favorites. Remember, if you want to call in and talk to Don Stinson, the number is 646-716-9922. And we do have a caller. And if I can see, I know it's a little dim in here, but this is somebody who's, I think, has their own cushion right here in Madame Perry's salon. Come on in and talk with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so great to be back. This is Andrea, California.
Hi, Andrea.
Glad to have you coming on the show. Thank you, sweetie.
Can you believe the story? Telling Jim
Brown,
he gets up and walks away from Jim Brown.
I don't know. I gotta be honest. There's a lot of really implausible stuff going on. I've been researching this a little bit, and you were involved during this. Right before this whole Watergate thing blew up. And there you were rifling around at offices that nobody knows what you were doing in there. So what's up with that?
Well, actually, all of that went on really before I got involved in any of that stuff. I was a student, and I was a college freshman, and I did some minor volunteer work and those kinds of things. And the Watergate investigation was already underway by the time I went to work in the White House, which was February of 1973. I got to know a number of the people. Well, you know, about as much as somebody who was as unimportant as I was got to know anyone. You know, some of the people who were involved in Watergate and would run into them from time to time before they – you know, either got fired or they left. But no, I had nothing to do with all of that. I just got or so I say,
that's
right. No, I don't have any stories about that kind of stuff. No.
Yeah, because from the timing it looks like as soon as you got there everything went to hell in a handbasket.
There are people who have said that about a lot of things about me in life, that everything was fine till I showed up, you know, so maybe, you know, But
Now, you know,
I didn't.
All right, excuse me. As the host here, right. I'm a little confused because, you know, Andrea, you're saying what I was thinking, but I didn't want to say. And yet, Don, you're telling another story. Of course, that was back before there was like a – everybody had a some kind of a Google Glasses that could record a conversation. There were no security cameras. And just to get be clear, Don.
Yes.
You want to tell the full story here about you meeting a man? Oh, what was his name? I think it was you were supposed to bring some drinks back for a fellow named Don Kendall.
Yes, I did. This was another one of my more brilliant
yes,
moves.
Yes, I did.
And I'd grown up in Atlanta, you know, the home of Coca-Cola, and so I just need to tell you that on background. And the gentleman whose staff I was on. Was in charge of international economic policy. So there were lots of interesting people who would come in to see him from time to time, some of whom I recognized, others I didn't. And one day I was flagged down by his, they were called secretaries in that day, assistant today, much better term. Flagged down, and she was very upset, and she handed me some change, and she said, "Go down to the." We had vending machines there, and she said, "Go down to the vending machines, and get two Pepsis." And so I said, "Okay." And so I go down to the machine, I put the money in, and nothing comes out. I guess it was empty, and I probably beat the thing. I don't know, but nothing happened. But the Coke button worked. So I bought two Cokes, and I came right back upstairs. And she was such a wonderful woman, and I was so sorry to do this to her. I handed her these two Cokes and immediately watched the blood drain out of her face. And I had no idea why. And I remember very clearly she had a silver tray and, you know, an ice bucket and glasses and the whole thing. And she said to me, "Don, you wait right here." And she went into the office, and the next thing I hear is this laughter. Because, I mean, she had poured the drink. She didn't have the cans with her at the time. She had poured the drink. But I hear this laughter. And the door opens, and it's Mr. Flanagan, who's the assistant to the president. And he says, "Hey, Don, come in here a second." So I went.
Oh my God!
He said, "I want to introduce you to this guy," and his name was Don too. So I figured, you know, hey, that was nice. I could remember his name. And he said, "This is Mr. Kendall, Don Kendall, and he's the chairman of PepsiCo, the company that makes PepsiCo." And Mr. Kendall, who was also a very gracious fellow, said, "I got to ask you a question. Why did you get Cokes instead of Pepsis?" I said, "Well, the machine was broken." And then I said even worse, because Jennifer may remember back in the 80s when they used to have the Coke-Pepsi challenge. And I'm from Atlanta. I mean, we all drink Cokes down there and everything. Well, he just hollered. They just laughed like hell. And one of the great things was is that they were both such gentlemen. I mean, I knew a lot of people over the years as I moved up in the business ranks who would have fired people over that. I mean, I didn't know. And they were just very nice. And what I got in the mail, I don't know, a week or later or something like that, was a whole stack of coupons for Pepsis and a very nice note from Mr. Kendall saying that, you know, better come over on this side, son, and, you know, try these, and so I've been a Pepsi drinker ever since. That was kind of an ignominious moment. But those were the kinds of things I did. Not taping anybody. I didn't do those kinds of things. I made dumb mistakes. And then after that, not too long after that, then I went to work for Vice President Agnew. On the career decision that would just kind of be cool, because he was down around the hall.
Oh my gosh!
And I was very attracted. Again, you know, just a kid. And now, by now, I was an old man at 18, and You know, I never forget the vice presidential seal over the door and the flags, and I just thought that was the coolest thing. And one day I stumble into lots of things. This has happened my entire life. And I end up literally knocking over a guy who was at a water fountain filling up a coffee, the percolator. And
My God.
Well, turned out that he happened to be one of Vice President's speechwriters. And we got to be friends. And I ended up getting a job working for Vice President Agnew up on the top floor of the EOB. And this is about, I don't know, about a year, less than that, before I actually ended up working in the White House proper. But I worked up in this area where we did correspondence work, which was very interesting, and it was very weird because people would send in all sorts of strange stuff. I remember one day getting. I'll tell you this part of the story. I mean, one day, yep, it's a lot to go into for the book, but there was a family, and they were in the Midwest, who were very concerned that they had been cranially wired by Martians, and the mother had sent in hats for the vice president to wear that were made of aluminum foil, and the whole thing, because if you wore these they wouldn't come in. But it's worth reading the story because it was a very it's much more involved than that, and it was this whole thing about the aliens worked at the local grocery stores and the whole thing, and I believed it for a while, and then I said, nah, it's probably not true. But one day I had a very weird thing happen, and that was I opened up a thing that was a garbage bag, and it was stapled, and it was addressed to Spiro, like Speero, which was misspelling, Agnew, Agnoo. And it just said Washington, D.C., and it had a million stamps on it. And I guess at that time you could mail garbage, and maybe you still can. And I opened this thing up, and I looked in it, and there were things in there that were very disturbing, that I write about, but I won't go into it in here. But they were very disturbing. And so what I did, and it was a very interesting day, is that I ended up taking him down to the Secret Service. And the Vice Presidential Protective Division was down probably on the second floor where the Vice President's office was. And I went in there that day and gave it to one of the agents who, you know, those guys, they've seen everything. So to me, this was like a matter of immediate national security. To them, it was like, okay, it's another nut that sent something in. And I got a cup of coffee or something when I was there. I stole food all the time. And I said something to one of the gentlemen there. And the next thing I know, an agent who I had gotten to know turns to me and he said, "Hey, idiot, do you realize who that is?" And I said, "No." And he goes, "That's Clint Hill." Now, Clint Hill, to me, there is no one who has ever been a greater American hero than Clint Hill. And a lot of people, they don't know who he is, but if they are interested in history, they've seen a picture of a man who jumped on top of President Kennedy's limousine on November 22nd, 1963, from a moving vehicle. On top to, had he not done that, after the shots had been fired, Mrs. Kennedy might very well have tumbled into the street. I mean, it was just this horrible thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was an incredible, incredible guy. And still is. He's still alive. And he's an author. I highly recommend his books. He writes wonderful things. I mean, they're just very incisive and mind-blowing in many ways. But that was one moment where I had stumbled into something that was one of the highlights of my life. And that kind of went along with that. Again, in the thing of if you stay open to enough things, you get to have interesting experiences in life. I ended up getting to know two people. Clint Hill, who was an assistant director of the Secret Service, and the guy who had just been the Secretary of the Treasury, named John Connolly, who had been the governor of Texas. He was the one who was shot with what they called the magic bullet.
Right.
And so I had gotten to know, and I'm not real well, but I'd gotten, you know, to know him enough to be nodded at, I guess. You know, two guys who were in that car in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And that was, if you lived at that time, I mean, it's among the worst things that could ever possibly happen. And obviously it's been studied 92 ways to Sunday, and I got to meet and chat with both of those guys from time to time. So they were very, very, very interesting. But I worked for Vice President Agnew right until the day that he resigned, and then ended up temporarily sort of unemployed. But we had a moment where we were all called told to be at his. There was a scandal involved, unfortunately, with him, and we were called to his conference room at, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon on October the 10th, 1973, and no one knew what was going on. All of a sudden, the door just blew open, and in came the military aide to the vice president, who was a general. Who just took papers and he threw them down at the top of the table and he said, "Our leader has resigned his high office," and turned around and walked out. And that sent reverberations throughout the country that the vice president resigned. But I do have another odd little story that goes along with that, if you'd like.
Sure.
The night before, and I swear that this is true, I had a dream about a woman who, she actually worked for a guy who was just terrific name, who was Bob Hope's nephew, worked on the vice president's staff, and she was his assistant. And I had this dream in which I looked at her, and her mouth was just wide open. And then that was the end of the dream, and I woke up and whatever, and went on to work. So that day, I ended up standing next to her, believe it or not, in that room. And when he came in and said that he had resigned, I saw that look, right, her mouth open, just as it did in my dream.
Oh, my.
So
the Martians sent you a message.
You know, it's quite possible. It really, the Martians could have done that indeed, no doubt about it. But my prescience with things like that does not unfortunately extend to, like, the racetrack, the stock market, anything that's of any real value. So you can't win them all.
Yeah, me and you both, brother. If you just clocked in, we're talking with Don Stinson about his book, Downstairs at the White House, Story of a Teenager, an Oval Office, and a Ringside Seat to Watergate. Also here with me is my pal, Andrea Robinson from California. She's holding up the West Coast for me, and we both got Don in here. We're trying to see what is the truth. What is he really pulling our leg too, or is he responsible for more than he's claiming? Now that the years have gone by, and there's no way you can prove a doggone thing. There's so many more things I want to talk to you about too. While I've got you here.
Oh, I have papers. I come with papers. I can prove I was there. I mean, you know.
All right.
And
so,
what about the goats? Yeah.
What does that mean? Employment papers. Huh?
The goat that you fought with on the airplane?
Oh, that's another part of my life. Yeah.
Okay. See, I've been doing my research on you, but that's okay. We can save that
really
for another
have.
Time. But
you know almost everything embarrassing about me at this point.
Wow.
No, that was 20-some years later when I was in the newspaper business and I was doing some work in what was the old Soviet Union.
All right.
Yes, I did wrestle a goat.
I guess that'll be
and
the next
goat
one.
Let's, on an airplane. Yeah.
Well, I'll be darned.
Go ahead.
So, see, was it United? What was this?
Aeroflot.
What?
No, Aeroflot. where actually they did, you had chickens, goats, along with the passengers. There was no FAA in Russia.
Okay.
Quite a ways
right.
away from
so,
the White House.
Yeah.
All right. And before we go further, if you want to talk to Don Stinson, the number is 646-716-9922. Now, I've got to get to some questions here with you about and his book has only been out 2 weeks, and it's already an Amazon bestseller. So we still want to talk to you about Watergate, what it was like going on in the White House during Watergate. I want to know what it was like to talk to President Nixon and what he was like, Pat Nixon, what she was like in person. And you know the thing is when you talk about in the beginning of your book about, you know, Vietnam and Brezhnev and people like that, you know, people don't realize back then, and I'm closer to you and I are closer to being the same age than I normally admit, Don. But that was a big deal back then because before there was all these things, people would mimeograph something and pass it around, and it went around in my little neighborhood in Southeast Atlanta that Khrushchev said, I will reach you, I will own your country, I will do it through your children, and everybody had those things on their refrigerators and stuff. And I remember in the eighth grade, the high school that I went to, they wanted some people to take this Chinese language class so that they wouldn't lose the teacher because they didn't have enough people sign up for it. So they sent home letters to people that were good in English. My parents got the letter. They figured if we were good in English, we'd be good in Chinese. Where that correlated, I don't know. So they sent that home. And my parents were convinced ever since then that I was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, and every now and then I'd come home, my room would be totally torn apart looking for communists, some signs that I was a Red. And they never got over it. I could have been a card-carrying communist if you had offered me money to. But
Andrea, you better check in on Jennifer here.
I'm starting to take some notes here. This is another side that Jennifer I never knew before. Oh my gosh!
Listen,
maybe it's a good thing the Martians sent you to let me know.
That's right. The Martians sent me. That's right.
Bear in mind, my brother was one of the biggest dope dealers in the neighborhood. Not to mention, in his scout group was Mark David Chapman, who killed Lynn Hull, one of the two men, the two white men that'll never be out of prison. Or Mark David, you've heard me say this before, Andrea. Mark David Chapman and Charles Manson, the only two white men that you know will never get out of prison because they killed Lennon and the most beautiful white woman, okay? So, yes, yeah, he was in the neighborhood too, but no, I was the one that was going to bring down the government. I don't know.
Yeah.
So tell us about tell us about being there during Watergate. Talk about Nixon. Did you talk to Nixon? Did you talk to Pat Nixon, what they were like? I mean, you worked for Agnew, but tell us about the Nixons.
Well, after I they got us jobs, and I did a stint like really fast at what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, where that's a whole other story. I had to resign in order to get paid, so I was only there for, I don't know, 30 days or something like that. And then I got hired back in the White House as a messenger, which was like the best job ever. And I was in the East Wing. So I tell just a couple quick stories about Mrs. Nixon and President Nixon, who were, I think, much different than they have been portrayed in many ways. First, Mrs. Nixon was as classy and as kind a person as I have ever met. By accident one day, and I wrote about this, I mistook her for a maid in the residence because she had a scarf on her head and it was dark on a rainy day, and she said a term that she used, kind of an old term, kiddo. And she, you know, there weren't that many people that worked there, so people, you know, kind of recognized one another at least. And she said something to me like, "Hi, kiddo," and I said, "Hi, kiddo," back. Well, that got back to somebody on the First Lady staff who said, "How dare you do anything like that?" And at that time, actually, I had a temporary job working in the First Lady's press office, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to get fired. I mean, all this other stuff I'd done. I'd spilled water on Frank Sinatra. I'd done all this other crazy stuff. But now this is it. And and what happened is one day the lovely lady who was the First Lady's press secretary says to me, come in my office. And I went in and I figured, okay, that's it. And she's on the phone, and she hands me the phone. And I'd written a letter of apology to Mrs. Nixon for saying that, calling her kiddo, because that was just not, you know, done. And she wanted to talk to me, and she said, you know, that was so nice. You didn't have to write a letter or anything like that, but that was just the nicest thing. And we just had this nice chat, and I guess she was just upstairs or whatever, but we just had this really nice chat. And at the end, she went, okay, see you later, kiddo. she was just incredibly lovely. And every time I would run into her, she'd ask me about how my mom and my dad were. She made you feel like you were somebody. And incredibly kind. President Nixon, who had been made out to be as very cold and aloof, I found him to be different than that.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of shy, in a way. I've been fortunate in meeting other presidents over the years, and he was much different than any of the others that I had met or chatted with, in that he was very intense. And I remember, I put it this way, I have never in my life since ever met anybody, and I use this word, with the kind of voltage that I felt from President Nixon. I mean, he, despite Watergate, he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He was absolutely brilliant. And we ended up, the reason we ended up talking is because he was a big fan of Theodore Roosevelt. So was I. I was carrying a book about Teddy Roosevelt, and he stopped me one morning because I used to figure out a way to go down that, what's called the West Colonnade. As he was going to the Oval Office and I was going to the East Wing to go to work so I could say good morning, Mr. President. And he stopped me that one day and we had that chat. He also, on another occasion, tried to point out to me that they were getting on Marine One to fly off somewhere, and after that was over, I took a step and tripped and fell over and realized that at one point President Nixon had been pointing to me, trying to tell me that my shoelaces were untied. So, you know, but anyway, but they were very nice people. I was there also with the Fords, who were incredibly nice as well. Different.
Okay. Hold on, before you go, because nice. I want to know, Don. I want to know the rest of this, but before we go any further, remember, you've only got about seven more minutes to talk to Don Stenson.
Oh,
the number
okay.
646-716-9922. And guess what? Somebody else has stepped in here. It's a little dim. I know, but it's part of the ambiance. It's to make you feel uninhibited when you're speaking about these important government things that you did. And I'm about to so come on. And, you know, I've always read that Nixon was one of the great legal minds. He had just a remarkable legal mind. And yet even Dick Cavett, who, you know, kind of bantered and sparred with him over the years, even said, you know, approached him sometimes and said, you know, he could be very, very shy in public, very, just, you know, pretty much one-on-one. But if you could just, Andrea, would you reach over and just sort of open the little beaded curtains, please, for me?
Oh, sure.
Hi,
no
welcome.
Problem.
Come on into. Thanks, son. Come on into Madame Perry's salon and have a seat.
Who, me?
Hello? Yes, yes,
hello?
You.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Don't be shy.
Oh, I'm
yeah, you're among friends.
Yeah, hi. Who do we have here? And is he sitting on my burritos?
Well,
I would never sit on burritos.
Wait a minute. Is this
I know I left
him
in here somewhere.
Talk about a great legal mind. Is this Cornell? Talk about the greatest legal mind and opera singer in Reno, Nevada, Rick.
Mm.
Come on
well,
in.
Rick
get
is,
comfortable.
Wow.
Is he here too?
Oh, wait, this is not Rick. This is Brett.
This is Brett. Yeah,
right.
Rick, I don't know where he's at.
Brett,
I left
right.
him singing somewhere.
Brett.
Yeah, he was
okay,
he was standing in line at the taco
me.
Truck, and I said,
yeah,
hey,
yeah.
You know, I hear there's this guy who likes looking, who likes hanging out like outside Oval Offices and stuff, and oh my God, I'd really love that.
Yeah, yeah. Don, just to clarify,
yeah,
this is Brett Wright, yes, retired chief petty officer from the U.S. Navy and burrito.
And pleasure to meet you.
So.
Good to meet you, too. Hi. So I don't come in here and cause too much trouble usually, although I understand she's still steam cleaning from the last time. So take that with whatever grain of salt you would like. So I came in late. What sort of trouble are we in? And can I cause some?
Okay, so far, we've already gotten called down for... Let's see, he poured water on Frank Sinatra, he dissed Jim Brown, and didn't believe that Jim Brown was, in fact, Jim Brown, and walked away from him there. And,
oh, my God, have you even missed Jim Brown?
Andrea.
Really?
Yeah,
I got it. I have a million embarrassing
Brown.
Stories.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else? He called Pat Nixon kiddo, but he wrote her a nice letter because he mistook her for a maid when she was wearing a scarf. And but she was very gracious to him before and after that. And what are we up to now? Up there talking about Nixon and oh, go on. And then I've got another question. Brett. Brett,
yes.
And when he was asked to get some Pepsis for the head of the guy, the chairman of PepsiCo, although he didn't know that's where he was, he brought Cokes because he was at one time a very fine citizen of Atlanta, Georgia. And because the Pepsis wouldn't come out of the machine.
So basically,
yeah, they all had a jolly laugh.
So basically, the biography here would be called My Life in the City of Faux Pas.
There you go. You know, that's an excellent title.
Okay.
I may steal that and use it as a subtitle. If anyone could make a faux pas, it was me. That's for sure.
I lived that, so I feel you.
I mean, I can tell you one thing in what time we have, if you'd like, about the day that President Nixon resigned.
Absolutely.
And,
yes.
And what happened? The first thing briefly, and I wrote about this, is that it was very eerie because the place seemed as if nothing had happened at all. And the night before we had had, the night before, a friend of mine and I had been in the press room when the president, after helping take some furniture out of the Oval Office. We were in the press room at the time the president was going to begin his speech to the nation to resign. My friend, who was even a bigger smart aleck than I am, said at about 2 seconds or so before it went on air, he said he's not going to resign in a loud voice, which then caused all sorts of TV lights and everything to go on because instead of our badges saying press, they said White House staff. And I had to keep – I remember Connie Chung was in my – she had a microphone. I'm going like, no, we're idiots. Okay. Just going, no, we're idiots. But the next day, which was very the day started as if nothing had changed. I remember very vividly, and again, I write about it, is standing out on the lawn, and as you watch the helicopter take off and then fly out towards the Washington Monument and then turn towards Andrews Air Force Base, there was a funny thing and a somber thing. And the funny thing was that there was a woman who, in a little group of friends, who said, he'll be back. And we said, like, what? And he goes, he's been through these things before. That helicopter is going to turn around and land, and he's going to catch the press blindsided, and he'll tell everybody that none of this was true, and he'll be right back in office. And, you know, you just kind of looked at her, and you go, wow, that's something, because that's never going to happen. Okay, that is never going to happen. And even weirder than that, because you kind of wondered where the hole was in her canoe. And that we no one knew who she was, and we never saw her again.
Oh, God.
She was a Martian, Andrea. She could have been part of that group. But the somber thing that day that I remember very well was there was a briefcase, a large briefcase. And when President Nixon got on the helicopter, this briefcase that was carried by a military aide did not go on the helicopter. And it was standing, the officer was standing behind Vice President Ford. Because the president had actually signed his resignation at 11:35 in the morning, or received at 11:35 in the morning. So the nuclear football that has all the nuclear codes did not go with President Nixon, who flew to his home in California, but stayed behind with the vice president, who obviously then became president. And that was a very sobering thing to watch, because it was a... it was a very peaceful transition of power, and then with the ultimate power of destruction, staying behind with the guy who was now going to take on that mantle of responsibility. So while there were many things that went on there over the time that I worked there that were very, very funny, there were also some things that were just very moving to watch and to see. And I think in the end, we could be very, despite what had happened, we could be very proud of ourselves as a country and as Americans for the way that we handled it. So, but I really enjoyed, I had a great time there. And you have to read about the book that showed up in my little cubby hole in the East Wing one day that had some amazing signatures in it. It's a document that I don't know what happened to it, but it was absolutely amazing. And then I kind of ended the book with a cliffhanger about something that happened with me and with President Ford in November. Because wow. you never know if you'll have a chance to write a sequel. So,
let me ask you this, Don.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I've got my great legal minds with me here and my great two members of my organization, though they'll never admit that publicly, Andrea and and Brett. And if I could just have another 5 minutes of your time, we'll do a lightning round. There's a couple of things I want, even just a quick thing going through here. And remember, this book is called Downstairs at the White House. It's a story of a teenager, an Oval Office, and a ringside seat to Watergate by Don Stinson. It's a fantastic book. In 2 weeks, it's become an Amazon bestseller. And you can get it paperback. You can get it in Kindle. Actually, I've got it both because I wanted to keep it with me even when I didn't have the book with me.
Thank you.
So I went ahead and got it on Kindle. And I don't get the book. I don't get a book twice. Let me tell you that this is that good. although you graciously gifted me, but so I'm going to go with a real quick lightning round. And Andrea and Brett, if you have something you want to, a question you want to ask too, now's our time while we've got him here. While we might get
God.
The story out
Hubert
of him.
Humphrey.
You write.
Yeah.
Hubert Humphrey. I mean, okay, so I was a little guy. I was maybe 10 years old when this happened. And suddenly, you know, I'm in my dad's garage, and he has the Tricky Dicky, you know, the poster up in his garage, and he comes and he says, "Well, he disappeared. Who knows where he's going? What did he do? Did he step out for pizza or I mean, whatever happened to that guy?"
Hubert Humphrey? Vice President Humphrey?
Or Spiro Agnew. I'm thinking Spiro Agnew. Spiro Agnew. Sorry about that.
After he resigned, he became an international business consultant and ended up living in Palm Springs, California. He was very close with Frank Sinatra, and they lived out there not too far from one another. And actually, oddly enough, I worked out there at one time. And
so you had an opportunity to kind of see what he was up to afterwards, too. I mean, did he ever talk about it?
You know, the funny thing about all this is that there are, you have, and particularly I was a kid when all of this went on, you have feelings about people that don't necessarily translate to the problems that they had. You know, I knew them more as just people that were larger than life. And we never had any conversation about any of that. But he became very successful. I tried to get him to come to a party that we had at the newspaper there in Palm Springs. Unfortunately, that he couldn't attend. My boss really wanted him to come. But again, to me, they were very nice people. And, everybody loses what they want. But he was very nice. A lot of the people that I worked with that he employed were some of the more brilliant people I've ever met. So he may very well had the issue of the problems that had been in Maryland. Had that never arose, he certainly probably would have become president when Nixon resigned, and or may have been elected in his own right if that had never happened in 76. He was the leading candidate at that time before he resigned. So, but they were very interesting.
Awesome.
Cool.
Fantastic. Don, I'm going to have to ask you, could you make a return appearance with us here? And I'm going to tell you something else. Every now and then, these two can attest, we have a sort of a roundtable discussion. We call it the Unusual Suspects in Madame Perry Salon. We'd also love for you to participate in one of those with us sometime.
I'd love to.
I think we're overdue,
aren't
we? That'd be wonderful. Okay. All right.
Oftentimes
great.
It involves adult drinks, I'm just saying.
Okay, that sounds really nice.
and snacks. And sometimes, believe me, you never know. You absolutely never know who will show up, what they will say. You could have, we could have some musicians. We could have authors. We could have artists, cartoonists. We could have, Harvey J.K., historians like that. Or we could have people just come in and say
more
something.
More than
like
our
that.
Share of the nattering nabobs of negativism.
yeah, we get that too.
Well, great. I'd love to come back. That would be
terrific. Special for you, Don. All right. And this is thank you, Andrea Robinson. Thank you, Brett Wright. Thanks to everybody who's listening. And this is Madame Perry once again saying I love you. And don't forget, everybody's got to